start, but we are going to open the House Interim Committee on Energy and Environment. This is our last committee. So appreciate almost everybody being here. I know Tobias, Representative Tobias Reed is going to join us a little bit later after his meeting. So today we have a pretty full agenda, a lot of water issues, and then we're also going to hear on some updates, some legislation from last session, and we had some discussions about the energy siting criteria at the hearing in Bend, so we're following up on that today. And then we also have possible introduction of committee bill. This is the gray water bill that we've been talking about for several committees. So first I'd like to invite the Water Resources Department up, and my understanding is Phil Ward can be here today, so we have Brenda Bateman and Barry Norris. Morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Committee members, for the record, my name is Brenda Bateman. I'm the Senior Policy Coordinator for the Water Resources Department, and this morning I have with me Barry Norris, a State Engineer for Water Resources. We wanted to provide an update to you on the Oregon Water Supply and Conservation Initiative, which, as you may recall, was funded by the 2007 legislature. We've been hard at work on this project ever since, both with internal staff and private contractors helping us. We are in a phase right now where we've collected all of our data, developed our tools and methodologies, and are preparing the data and tools to go up on our internet website for the public to use and for policymakers to use. We just wanted to give you a quick rundown of the initiative. You want to bring up the screen. As you recall, this is a modest effort that includes four different components, including community grants, an inventory of potential storage sites, both above and below ground, an inventory of conservation opportunities coming up in the future, and a water demand forecast. And I'd like to turn the presentation over now to Barry Norris to provide all of the details.
Good morning. Chair Dinkpelder and members of the committee. I'm Barry Norris with the Water Resources Department. We'll go through these parts of the initiative, each one of them one by one. We have slides made of computer screens, so while you're looking at a slide, I can't be interactive with it, but the idea is that these components are going to be interactive components on our website. So the first slide is of distribution of the grant program. We had 16 projects that we funded with the $200,000 that was supplied. There were $750,000 that were actually requested. So this is an indication of the interest in the grant program. They range from Seaside got a grant for to facilitate meetings to talk about regional water supply with their neighbors, to Baker County that got a grant to look at water availability for above ground storage projects. So that was kind of there was a whole range of projects, and they were fairly evenly geographically distributed around the state. They were a matching 25% matching grant.
Brenda, just a quick question. Can you go back one slide? My understanding is that the last Water Resources Commission, that the grants were actually suspended. They were put on hold, and so I think it would be important to explain to the committee about that.
Madam Chair, there are actually two grant programs that we have up and running right now. So this is a grant program that is for planning stages only, very early in the project development stage. And many of these grants were actually awarded to communities last spring. There are a few more that we would like to award and may or may not be able to, given the current economic situation. There's a second grant phase that we have underway right now that is specifically for feasibility studies, more specific studies of actual projects that our commission discussed during their last meeting and was prepared to provide some funding for, but has put on hold until a meeting that they're holding this Friday. So that's actually a second grant program, and this earlier one for planning, most of which was awarded last spring.
Okay, and that's all under the Senate Bill 1069 now, that source of funding, or is that separate pots? That's what I just want to clarify.
These are separate pots of money. This money under the initiative was awarded in the 2007 legislature compared to the 1069 feasibility study grants that were awarded last February during the 2008 session.
Next component of the supply initiative is storage. We have mapped over 1,200 sites on an interactive website You'll be able to search for those different sites by county or by basin, find the listing of them. You can click on one of them and map it. They're mapped both Google Earth and Google Map options. Click on those, and you can get all the data that's available, including, well, down here is a list of some of the data that's available on this particular site, which is the Coffee Pot Dam proposal down in Lake County. You can see there's a capacity curve available. There's photos of the site. There are maps of the site, quite a bit of information, engineering reports, and so on. So anybody that's interested in that site or any site around the state can go to this type of a page, call up that information, see everything that's been done on that site, and then decide if they want to look at that alternative in more detail or whatever they'd like to do. Underground storage assessment has also been done around the state to look at the feasibility of storing water below ground, taking, as an example, surface water, and either using artificial recharge or aquifer storage and recovery, injecting it below ground, and say, wintertime flows, and using it during the summer when it's needed. The object of this assessment was to do a complete desk-level assessment of sites around the state, call them data points, look at the physical capacity of the aquifers to accept that water, and then take that water back out during the summertime, and then present those results on the website. We came up with a method to rate the opportunity for storage below ground around the state. This is a color-coded map of that rating system. You can see that although the red areas show less storage opportunity, that doesn't mean that it isn't feasible at all. There are, of course, local sites around where it is feasible. And, of course, the green sites show that the aquifer characteristics make it make the opportunities for storage very high. Again, we map our data points around the state, so anybody interested in below ground storage can look at the data point distribution in the area that they'd like to investigate and click on those data points or select an individual site in a tabulated format. You can either map it or look at the details. For instance, choosing the city of Tigard as an example, you click on that and you could see that it's got ASR feasibility report that was done by a consultant, their annual reports on operating under a limited license, how much water they've stored and how much they've taken back out of the aquifer, the water quality information that's available, an overview of the project for this particular one, and all of the well logs that are associated with the site. So somebody that's interested, say perhaps a neighbor of the city of Tigard that's interested in doing that type of work, can go to the site, can look up all the information, and see what's been done in their area of interest. Also, of course, on Google Map, you can look and see where that particular data point is located. Another phase of the supply initiative is an inventory of conservation projects. To accomplish that, we did surveys around the state and workshops and collected information on potential conservation projects. This is the type of information that we have compiled and have in a database. You can read for yourselves a list of types of information. This is a distribution of how that information came out. The upper graph shows that from the survey and the projects that we collected, 28% of them were agricultural-type projects and 72% were municipal. So then down below on the lower left, you can see that 92% were capital improvement projects of the agricultural projects, and only 8% were programmatic, like public information, those kinds of things. Capital improvement would be, say, lining ditches or rebuilding pipelines to conserve water. And then on the lower right, the municipal projects, 35% were capital investment-type projects, and 65% were programmatic. Now, the total number of projects we got back and have in the inventory is 135. One of the first things that might strike you about this is that with 80 to 85% of the water that's diverted in the state by agriculture, 80% of the respondents were agricultural projects, that shows that this type, there's a whole lot of this type of work that still needs to be done to work with agricultural interests to develop projects and get them on the drawing board and figure out how more conservation might be done. Obviously, the stopping, the problem is funding resources, where municipal type projects typically or organizations typically have a funding source, pretty stable funding source. An organization that can look at projects like that, it's not so apparent with the agricultural users.
Very good question about that breakdown. I see here in the notes you had 36, as you mentioned, agricultural responses. Was that primarily irrigation districts or individual irrigators?
Districts.
Jenningfelder districts.
And did you, I mean, what, you know, mechanism did you use to try to reach individual irrigators? Because we know that there are parts of the state where you have individual irrigators who are actually using, you know, have a large water right. Was there an attempt to send out to, like, all large agricultural water right holders, or?
Jordan Taylor, we of course had workshops, and we advertised them and invited people in. We used various organizations such as the Water Resources Congress to contract people, of course irrigation districts, and we did send out letters to every organization connected with water that we could think of. We sent out, I don't know, maybe nearly 1,000 of them, I think. I just think that in order to continue this project and really, really do a good job of it, it's going to be a lot of work and it's going to take a lot of time. It's just something that there aren't a lot of conservation projects that people may have given some thought to in passing, but haven't given enough thought to really compile things like costs and how exactly they work and to add it to the database. They're out there, but they're going to need some help. People are, organizations and users are going to need some help in developing those concepts. The last phase that I want to talk about is our demand model. This it's a Excel spreadsheet. It's a very, very large spreadsheet. It is it's interactive. It provides a base water demand, but it's also interactive in that you can model your own customized water demand for your area. This is the this comes up. First page of the spreadsheet, what you see, and you can go to the instructions or main menu or summary of the results. If you go to summary of the results, you'll see a page like this. And what you can do just with this reference demand study, and when I say reference demand study, that's the demand study that the consultant came up with based on their best estimate of all the parameters, population projections, per capita water use, crop acre by acre water use, and those kinds of things. You can see that it ranges total from 8,934,000 acre feet per year to a projection in the year 2050 of 10,310,000 or 311,000 acre feet per year. So it'll increase a little over a million acre feet per year by 2050, their best estimate. Now you can go up to this interactive part of the page here, and you can go from statewide to an individual basin, administrative basin, or you can also go to counties. And you can change from acre feet to gallons per day and different types of unit if you want to. For instance, for municipal use, you might want to look at gallons per day. And then you can also have the opportunity to use different types of charts to look at it. Now, I have two examples to what we would call an override to the reference demand study that I want to show you. One's for agriculture and one's for domestic well use. For instance, if I were to go into the database, and you, let me back up once. Well, you can go into the database and click to an agricultural override. Go in and take a look at, for instance, Baker County. And this is all the data that drives the demand study, or some of it you see, that drives the demand study for agricultural use in Baker County. And I decided, just as an example for your use, that I would change conveyance efficiency in the year 2010, 2015, and 2020. I would increase it by 1% every 5 years. So, for instance, if I were a county planner in Baker County and I said, well, we have some leaky canals and we have some leaky pipelines, and I think I can improve my conveyance efficiency for agriculture overall in the county by 1% every 5 years for 3 years. Now, also, in the year 2015, just as an example to show you, and in the year 2020, I'm going to increase my irrigation efficiency. I'm going to, say, go from maybe some flood irrigation to some sprinkler irrigation, or for some high head sprinklers to low head or something like that. And I'm going to be able to realize a 2% gain in efficiency in 2015 and then another 2% in 2020. And that's my override. I'm going to leave everything else the same. I go back and I take a look now. This is my reference demand study that the consultant came up with. And this is a new curve adding those efficiencies. So I'm going, for agriculture, I'm going from 994,000 acre-feet of water per year to 927,000 acre-feet of water per year in the year 2050. So I've managed to save a little over 60,000 acre-feet with those efficiencies, which is about 20,000 acres of land potential, or 60,000 acre-feet of water. So that is, I hope you're starting to understand how the local planners, as well as the statewide planners, can use this model to use different scenarios to come up with estimates of demand out to the year 2050. You can see that it provides demand 2010, 15, 20, and so far out to the year 2050.
So is this based on just, and I'll take a look at it on the web, but is this based on watershed or it's by county?
You're able to, Chair Dainfeller, you're able to do your projections statewide or by county or by water basin, administrative basin.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you can choose up here whether you want to...
It's just hard to see on that, yeah.
Okay. But those are the three options, statewide, county, or basin. Now, the second example I wanted to show you is for domestic wells. These are the wells that are outside of municipal areas, which you'd call exempt well use. Again, this happens to show a bar chart, and the domestic wells are in blue. But what I want to call your attention to is the reference use or demand from 2007 up to 2050 for domestic wells goes from 47, 56, 600 to 78, 28, 500, and I chose Jackson County, just one county.
Mm-hmm.
And so it increases, I don't know.
Yeah, this isn't based on actual measurement. Is it based on the 15,000 gallons per day allowance, or how is that calculated?
This is based, Chair Dingfeller, this is based on a survey by our consultant that went developed a number of data points around the state and figured out what the per capita use is for domestic wells. And they did it for municipalities, industrial use, and also for municipal demand. So this is based on real data. This is based on what their best understanding of per capita use. I'll show you, as we go back again, like we did for agriculture, we go to the data mm-hmm. for domestic wells. You can see up here, I hope you can see, for Jackson County.
Yeah, it's not that good. You have to read it to us.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're being a little challenged up here with...
We don't have our binoculars with us today.
That's okay. We'll
well, they're using during April, May, June, July, August, and September, 116 gallons per capita per day during those months. Now, that's for indoor use. This also gives an estimate of outdoor use, as you can see, indoor and outdoor. You can override these numbers, and I did it in pink, and I did it from the year 2010 out to 2050. I changed it from 116 gallons per capita a day. And I said, okay, Jackson County has decided to go out with some public information and a campaign to get people to reduce from 116 gallons per capita a day to 100 gallons per capita a day. And what you don't see down here below is that I changed it in Jackson County for these 6 months out to the year 2050. And I left outdoor use the same. You can see it rises, or you can't see it rises in the middle of June, July, and August, and then goes back to nearly zero in the winter. And these are the numbers that now it projects. This is the reference. From 78.28, it drops to 75.13, so you're saving 300,000 gallons of water per day, or you could serve another 3,000 customers if you reduce that by 16 gallons per capita today in the spring, summer, and fall months. So those, again, are the types of scenarios that a local planner or statewide planner can use. There are all a range of options. You saw in the agricultural use, I'll just back this up, I didn't point it out before, that actually in each county we have all the different types of agricultural crops that are being used. So you can change them for individual crops. You can change the number of acres that are projected to be irrigated and crop use. So that's a very short summary of our project. We'd be happy to take any questions.
Anyone have any questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Barry, this handout, I don't know if you were going to go into this anymore about the base scenario and additional scenarios.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, I'd be happy to. I wasn't planning to go into any more detail, but I'd be happy to
yeah,
do
if
that.
You, if you could just briefly, and then I have another question.
I had some questions about the scenarios.
Well, the base scenario, Representative, is the scenario that I showed you that is
right.
The reference scenario.
Right.
And then there are other scenarios in the report that the consultant produced that they did two different scenarios in the report that's produced, and it'll be available on our website. You can go through and read those. One of them they did assuming that climate change is going to require people to use more water. And so they increased the amount of water per capita per day that's needed by people and municipalities and domestic users and so on and agriculture. And they did that based on certain assumptions because of the higher temperatures, and they showed how much the demand would increase. And then they did something similar for another scenario like I did, and they used conservation, and they showed what statewide water demand would be based on their other scenario. Now, they applied what they called Monte Carlo technique, and they gave a range of values for their scenarios. We don't have that ability in our model that's going to be available for use by people because that's a proprietary software, and it wasn't part of the project. But they did provide it on their scenarios, and so not only did they come up with numbers at the end of their demand estimates, but they give a range based on that probability that shows a high and a low. So if you want to really get into it and understand a lot more about it, you can read the report and see what the Monte Carlo application produced.
Okay. Did you follow up?
Yeah, please. So I'm presuming then that the assumptions on especially the climate change scenario were all documented in this report. That's what I was kind of curious about, was what the assumptions were, because there was no discussion about that in this handout.
Chair Dingfield, Representative Burley, that's correct. The assumptions are in that report.
Okay. One last question.
Your follow-up.
Thank you. Also on this handout, you talk about in-stream assessments, where the project team conducted an assessment of in-stream needs for ecological purposes. Would you elaborate on what those are? Are those, you know, in-stream rights that we have now, or those things that we anticipate in the future? Because when I look at that, for example, in the Willamette Basin, it's approximately 11 million feet, which is the high end of the base scenario range. It's quite a bit of water. So would you elaborate on what those are, please?
Yes. Chair Dingfield, Representative Burley. That isn't part of the in-stream demand is not part of the demand forecasting model. The way that was approached is the consultant met with our department, met with DEQ, met with Parks and Fish and Wildlife, and agreed to a process for forecasting in-stream demand. And the way that was done is by taking all of the existing in-stream demand, in-stream water rights and scenic waterways, and we separated the state into climate regions. And then we took each basin and county, and you can look at it. No, you can look at it by basin only, not county. Took each county, and we looked at the outflow streams from each county and each basin. Now, most of the basins are contained, but some of them, such as on the coast, will have a number of streams coming out. And we looked at every stream that does not have an in-stream water right. We took the ratio of all of the existing in-stream demands that the scenic waterways or the in-stream water rights, the consultant took it, when I say we, and got a ratio of that to the natural flow. And then he applied that ratio to the streams that are not already protected. And so by doing that, the basins, the outflow from all the basins have a forecasted in-stream demand. And then that was compiled in the report. And you'll see a table and a map representing the in-stream forecast.
Quick follow-up, and then we'll have to move on.
So the 11 million feet in Willamette, 3 to 4 coastal basins, 1 to 4 in the others, is that in addition to the in-stream rights already in place?
Chair Kingfeller, Representative Burley, that includes the in-stream rights that have already been established. It's a total.
Thank you.
Okay. The final question is, can you talk a little bit about next steps and the use of this information and, you know, how you're going to get this to planners at the county level or municipal folks that want to use it? Are you holding workshops or trying to, you know, explain to people how to use this as a tool?
Yes, Madam Chair, as you may have seen as we went through some of these scenarios here, they really help ask help us to ask questions and help communities to ask questions of themselves in terms of policies or incentives and programs that can be put in place. We already have had inquiries from a couple of counties who would like for us to come and meet with their staff and their communities and talk about the ways in which this tool can be used. One of the things that we're very excited about with this tool is that we not only now have some data for use, but we also have the tool in place that we can use as we get more data, as we update data in the future, and that can be used moving forward. So we're having those conversations already. We're going to be doing quite a bit of outreach with regard to the posting of the tool and the data on our website after the first of the year, and so that will be the opportunity when folks can really get in there and use this tool and do some customization as we played with a little bit this morning. So I think that's where the real opportunities will come. And as you're aware, the department is using this work, the policy work, the data work, the storage, conservation, other programs that we've been working on as a foundation for the long-term strategy work that our commission and department will be engaged in moving forward in the next several months and years. And so this will provide quite a good foundation for us to build upon.
Well, I look forward to hearing more about it. I definitely see this as a tool, obviously, as we're looking at what the demand is and what the actual availability is and how we're going to meet that demand or look at more aggressive conservation in areas that, you know, we can invest in those resources, because certainly I think that's going to be at least expensive option for some communities, and necessarily we're not going to have the money to build new water storage facilities all over the state. Obviously, it's a very expensive proposition. So look forward to hearing more about this. I'll certainly go on the web and play with it, and I'm sure I'll have lots more questions. Thanks again.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, next on the water agenda here is the update on the statewide water roundtables, and I gave an update on that last time. Since then, we've completed all the water roundtables, and we have with us today Gail Achterman from the Institute of Natural Resources, Todd Jarvis from the Institute of Water and Watersheds, both from OSU, and Terry Buchholz from David Evans. Thank you all for coming here today to provide us with the final presentation.
Thank you very much. We have a hydrologist, an engineer, and a lawyer, so we hope we can answer all of your questions.
Thank you,
Chair Dingfelder. My name is Gail Achterman. I'm director of the Institute for Natural Resources, part of the Oregon University System. It was my pleasure with the Institute and the Institute for Water and Watersheds, where Dr. Jarvis is the associate director, to organize the statewide water roundtables at your request and the request of Representative Cliff Bentz, who is also active in them.
Who, by the way, tried to get here this morning but got stuck in Boise.
Well, it happens.
He
time
apologized.
Of year.
But, yeah.
We had a number of sponsors from non-governmental organizations and businesses, the Central Oregon Cities, League of Oregon Cities, Oregon Trout, National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, Oregon Water Utilities Council, all of whom contributed to making the roundtables possible. The mission was really to get input from Oregonians for you, for the Water Resources Department, for the Governor's Office, for anyone who's interested in water policy for the future in Oregon, get input from Oregonians on where do Oregons think we are in terms of water management, where do Oregonians want to be in terms of water management, and what some approaches might be. We had the roundtables in five different locations, and there were a total of about 300 participants. There's some double counting here because some people went to more than one session, but we were in Bend, in Newport, in Ontario, in Medford, and here in Salem. So we had a very enthusiastic participation from around the state.
I'm Terry Buchholz. I'm with David Evans and Associates, and I help facilitate the five roundtables that happened across the state. The participants at all five of the roundtables represented a very broad range of water users with a heavy interest, I would say, in both Ontario and Medford from the agricultural community. Very knowledgeable participants in all of this, I would say, ranging from those that knew the issues and knew them very well to those that knew their perspective of the issues. So a very knowledgeable group. There was also a very broad range of concerns about water, ranging from water quantity, water quality, funding issues, public outreach, just a very broad range of interests. And I guess we did a survey as part of the roundtables, and what happened was people were not very optimistic about the current or the future water supplies in the state. When people were asked where they felt whether we had the supply right now for all Oregonians, it was an excess of 50% didn't feel that we had the supplies. And then when you look 20 years out, it went up even higher, that up to 70-80% of the participants didn't feel that we would have adequate water supply for Oregonians in 20 years. As part of the roundtables, we also had expert presentations in addition to getting input from the participants. And the expert presentations were geared to the region that we were had the roundtable in. And the expert presentations included Oregon Water Resource Department, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, Department of Environmental Quality, the Corps of Engineers for the Willamette Valley roundtable, irrigation district managers in both Ontario and in Medford, and city and wastewater managers gave presentations in Bend and Newport. We had tribal representative expert presentation in Ontario, and in several of the locations we had non-governmental organizations like the Nature Conservancy and others.
I think it's also useful to add there's a website for the roundtables and all of the presentations that we have in electronic form, and we do have most of them in electronic form, are posted on the website so people can refer back to them because they contained just an incredible amount of information. Some of the what we had folks do was brainstorm on the issues. What issues did they see for water in Oregon? And then talk about what they saw as some of the solutions for addressing those issues. And to go quickly through these issues, and there are literally dozens of issues that were identified, and the final report for the project is going to try to synthesize this a little bit more than the PowerPoint can, but there was almost universal concern about a lack of funding for water and wastewater infrastructure, and with the aging infrastructure, whether it's a treatment plant or an irrigation water delivery system, but also for funding for the management, whether it's the local irrigation irrigation district or the state agencies to actually manage the water resources effectively. There was widespread concern about the protection and recognition of existing water rights and existing water uses, and a concern that people didn't really understand, the general public didn't understand how water is used and what water use means for the vitality of their local community and their local economy. There were a lot of concerns about water quality. Interesting, though, is that it was mostly focused on non-point sources of pollution and a concern about what I put as, I summarize crudely as microcontaminants, but the kind of contaminants that are things like drugs that our traditional water treatment systems can't have a hard time treating. And so that concern came up in several of the roundtables. A lot of concern about integration between our land use planning system and our water resource planning and management, that the pieces don't really fit together very well, and concern that is the Big Look Task Force actually addressing those issues. Questions and concerns about the impact of climate change on water resources. Almost across all of them, concerns expressed about the need to continue watershed restoration for wetlands, floodplains, in-stream flows. And I was quite interested that in Medford and Ontario both, there was real concern raised about interstate water allocation and management for both surface and surface water and groundwater. Concern in the southern Oregon area about groundwater, that aquifers that cross over into California, and then concern in the Snake Basin, the Snake Columbia Basin, about the demands being made by Idaho and Washington on the water vis-a-vis the uses that are made in Oregon, and are we really protecting Oregonians' interests?
And sort of boiling that down into some of the key messages we heard from all five roundtables was that there really is a strong need for integrated water management planning and implementation in the state. And one thing that came across loud and clear was one size does not fit all. People feel that there's regional solutions, that maybe you provide a framework, but regional solutions are needed in order to meet those regional needs, and that public information and education about water and water management is really needed, that the general public doesn't understand the great value that water brings to the state, and having a reliable supply, how important that is to the state. Another very, very key thing that came out, and maybe this is one of those byproducts of the roundtables, is that no matter where people stood on the issues, and Ontario was a very good example of very broad water interests, people really understand that collaboration is needed in order to work on a solution to water issues across the state, and they feel that they need to do that by region also. And so that was a very strong byproduct in hearing the issues of that broad range and having them come together in small groups and work on solutions in a very collaborative manner.
I think, as we mentioned before, just a footnote on Terry's comments, there was almost universal concern by these very 300 very knowledgeable water folks around Oregon that about the general public not understanding the importance to conserve water, to not leave the water running when you don't have to, that the uses and benefits of water, that people don't really understand how important agricultural water use is to agriculture and to secure local food supplies, and the fact that people unintentionally are polluting waters, maybe because they just don't know better, by all kinds of day-to-day practices that they engage in, which underscores the need for public information and education. They really did come up with some amazing solutions, and this list does not do justice to all the innovative approaches that the participants suggested. One idea is that we need a statewide framework for integrated water management that could regionally be customized, because there really are some great examples in the Umatilla Basin, Walla Walla Basin, Deschutes, where they've come up with ways of doing this, but they're all one-off at this point, and other communities might be able to do more if some statewide framework could be developed. The other comment they made, and this came from all the water users, is that as they look at developing water conservation projects, watershed restoration projects, they really feel that even though we have a funding shortfall, I mean, we don't have enough money to do everything we want to do, but we could maximize the use of the funds we have if there was better agency coordination and streamlining of funding sources. That whether you're an irrigation district or a watershed council, you have to go to dozens of different sources of funds and programs in order to put the money together to do your project. And there's a lot of frustration about that. There's a lot of interest in water reuse, of strong feeling that incentives need to be provided for people to improve their use of water, and that might happen through pricing and markets or other incentives. A very high level of interest in water storage and conservation, and very much along the lines of the presentation you heard earlier from the Water Resources Department. A shared concern about local food supplies, that we want to be a state where we get our food locally, produced locally, and often with irrigation. And then this concern that we really haven't paid much attention to interstate compacts, to agreements with our neighboring states over how water is going to be allocated and managed in the future. So to kind of sum up what we've heard and what you'll see, I think, in the final report, there is a very high level of interest in water, as indicated by the willingness of people to take 6 hours of their day and come and participate in the roundtables, that people with very disparate views can and do come together at the regional level to find solutions to water management problems. And there were examples of that at every single roundtable, where there have been community solutions developed locally. And that there's a broad agreement on a number of different solutions, some of which are pretty simple, like almost universally, particularly in light of climate change, the notion that these very rigid seasons of use and storage seasons that are in existing water rights at a time of when we have climate change, but when we know we have variability in the water season every year, it doesn't really, those rigid times don't make a whole lot of sense. If you could be storing water earlier and your reservoir permit says you can't store before X date, it's fairly arbitrary to not have more flexibility in the way the water rights are administered, whether it's for storage or in-stream use, and those are the kinds of solutions that people seem to be able to come together around, and there are more of them that will be reflected in the final report. With that, we'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Representative Brown.
Welcome. Within the past 30 days, the Department of Interior and Pacific Corps announced the possible largest dam removal in the history of the United States. Yet you have a meeting in Medford. You don't come to Klamath Falls. I find that disappointing. But I would like to know, because part of the agreement is that FERC will not be involved in the scientific study to take place between now and the possibility of the dam removal, what will be your participation in that science? A. B. Will you be participating? Which may be A. So,
Representative Chair Dingfelder, Representative Girard. Number one, we were disappointed that we couldn't do the roundtables in many more communities around the state. There are a lot of there's tremendous variation in the issues. There's some common themes, but there is variation. We had a number of people from Klamath Falls who did go over the hill and participated in Medford, just like we had people from Walla Walla that came down to Ontario. But it was just we simply didn't have enough funding to be able to do the round tables in as many communities as we'd like. Quite frankly, I have had, and I don't think any of the others on the panel or the participants in the round table have had any direct involvement in the Klamath settlement negotiations, and so unless and until, so we can't comment on any of it at this point. And in terms of the Oregon State University system and Oregon State University in particular, unless and until the participants in that process or people who would like to be participants in the process solicited the assistance and scientific input of the university, I don't believe the university would get involved. Dr. Campana, who is the director of the Institute for Water and Watersheds, did serve on the most recent National Research Council report on the Klamath, but that was a volunteer exercise. So unless someone invites the university scientists to the table, the university scientists aren't going to be participating. Dr. Jarvis, would you like to add anything?
You know, I concur with Gail Achterman's assessment of that. We simply just can't walk in unless we're invited.
Quick follow-up. Let me know whatever I can do to get you an invitation.
Thank you very much, Representative Gerard.
Any other questions about the roundtables? Well, I just want to thank you for all your hard work and participation in the roundtables, and we're all looking forward to seeing the final report, which, do you have a sense about when that's going to be available and posted on the Institute for Water and Watersheds website?
Chair Dingfelder, I am very hopeful that it will be before Christmas. I am personally committed to making sure that it is before Christmas. We were very hopeful that we were going to try to get it out to you today, but we're still not satisfied with the way that we've done the... I want to do some more data analysis so that we make sure that it really portrays everything we heard, because it is a rich source of information on Oregonians' perspectives on these issues.
And I know Dr. Campana couldn't be here today, but and I don't know, Todd, if you're going to be participating in this, but there's going to be a presentation to the Environmental Quality Commission next week, and in January to the Department of Fish and Wildlife Commission, and last week there was a presentation to the Water Resources Commission. And certainly I think if anybody requested a presentation, I'm assuming that you'd be happy to make that available or try to present it at the request of any organization like to hear the results. We've also, it's been presented to the governor's H2O advisory committee as well.
Chair Dingfelder, thank you for noting that. Yes, we are willing to do presentations to anyone who is interested. All of the, not only the presentations, but the report and all the raw data will be posted on the site so people can look at it in as much depth as they would like. And we are also presenting next week to the Oregon Association of Water Utilities. So all of the water utilities from around the state. So
thank you. And we'll make sure that members of this committee get the copy of the final when it's available.
Thank you very much.
Thank you again. Okay, well, try to make up some time here. I will be very brief on the next presentation, which is about the exempt groundwater well work group. Fortunately, we do not have the final report either, which will be sent out as soon as that's available. But I just wanted to let the committee members know a little bit about the process and what came out of it. There's a number of folks. Actually, I'm going to ask folks in the audience who are participants in the exempt groundwater well work group, can you raise your hand? Yeah, I know you're leaving if you don't want to be part, but there are several others of you. You know, Sean from the Realtors, Water Watch. There was about 15 different stakeholders that were part of that. But you might remember last session. I'm sure you all remember last session. We had a bill on the exempt groundwater wells. There was a work group that met 5 times during the interim to see if there was any common ground that could be found. What was that comment about? Not forgetting
no
that.
Comment.
It's okay. And I first of all wanted to thank the Oregon Consensus, the National Policy Consensus Center at the Hatfield School of Government at Portland State University that facilitated the process. It was a really robust discussion. There's a lot of really good issues that came up during the discussion, too many numerous to mention here, but there was a lot of discussion about needing more data, the exempt well process that we currently have, do we need to have some type of registration fee, how can we get better information. And the good news is we actually came up with a couple of consensus items, and those two are being pursued now through the department. One is looking at the location of new wells, about getting better information. One thing that we learned is exempt groundwater wells are not, the information is not very precise. So we don't really know where they are. We don't really have good information about the location. And so for the future in putting in new exempt wells, having better information so the department can get a handle on where those wells are. As you could see, especially for the process that the department just went through, having accurate data is very important. So one recommendation would allow the Water Resources Department to get specific exempt well locations for new wells, and that the mechanics of that should be informed by a couple of groups already in place. There's a Well Drillers Advisory Committee. I know many of you would be very interested in reading the minutes, I'm sure, from the Well Drilling Advisory Council. But this is a group that gets together and talks about what the needs are for this industry that goes around the state drilling wells and making sure that that information is presented in a way that's meaningful for the department. So there was talk about getting input from that group, and also there's a Groundwater Advisory Council that advises the Water Resources Commission. So we made recommendations to them. And then there was universal support for increased funding for the Water Resources Department for more groundwater studies, because many of you know, and Representative Burley and I sat on the Ways and Means Committee, along with Representative Grigg, you were on there, we were able to get a very small amount for groundwater studies last session, and it is inadequate. And looking at ways that we can collect better data and have more accurate information for managing our water, our groundwater resources. And just a reminder that 70% of Oregonians get their drinking water and irrigation water from groundwater. So it's a pretty important resource. We tend to think more about streams and above ground storage. Groundwater is a huge source of water supply. So hopefully this report will be available soon. We'll get it out to all the members. There's a lot of good information in here. There's a lot of issues that weren't resolved that my sense is we're going to have continued conversations during the next session about that. And I just wanted to thank all the members of the work group who persevered over the 6 months of pretty intense discussions. But I think overall there were some very good conversations that happened, good information. The Water Resources Department was part of that, along with Department of Fish and Wildlife. And we had lots of local and regional participation as well. So with that, I'm ready to move on so we can stay on our agenda. And I'd be happy to discuss the final report more with anyone when it comes out. And we'll probably have a presentation at the next session meeting, probably in January. So with that, I would like to call up. We're just a few minutes behind schedule now and get back on track. We're going to move on to discussion about fish consumption rates and setting water quality standards for toxic pollutants. Neil Mullane from the Department of Environmental Quality. This is a process I know that has been going on for, several years, Neil?
Yes, it has been.
Several years. And my understanding is that the Environmental Quality Commission adopted the final standards a couple months ago. Is that correct?
Well, they adopted the recommendation of the department to move forward.
To move forward for the rate. Setting the, it's not final standards, but
not yet.
But congratulations on at least getting to that part. I know you've been working for several years to get to that part.
Yeah.
So if you can fill us in on what's happened to date and now what the next steps are for the department in setting the standards.
Certainly. Chair Dinko, elder members of the committee, my name is Neil Mullane, and I'm the administrator of the Water Quality Program for DEQ. And with me is Jennifer Weigel, who is the manager of the standards program for the department. And we're here today to kind of fill you in and give you some information on the work that DEQ has been doing to improve our fish consumption rate. And
I can do this. You're getting the slides. There we go.
Oops, I sort of jumped ahead there.
There we go. Okay, sorry, we moved away. So again, to give you an overview of what we've been doing on the fish consumption rate, and Throughout 2007, really we began in the later part of 2006, through 2008, the department has been collaborating with the EPA and the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation to review the fish consumption rate. Now, the fish consumption rate is a key variable in how we put together water quality standards for human health protection. So it's an important part of that factor that we use when we develop the water quality standards. And it really is supposed to represent the amount of fish or shellfish Oregonians are eating. And you would ask yourself, well, why do we want to review the rate? Well, to give you a little bit of history, in 2004, the department went through the process of reviewing our toxic criteria and developing those criteria based on a fish consumption rate of 17.5 grams per day. And so that represents really a small parcel of fish that people would eat daily. And if you look at it, it would really equate out to 2 8-ounce meals a month. And we were essentially using at that time the national data about what would be recommended for a fish consumption rate as we developed those standards. So in 2004, we developed those standards, went to the commission, the Environmental Quality Commission adopted those standards, and we submitted them to EPA. Well, during that period of time, we were also hearing from the Native American tribal governments that that particular fish consumption rate really didn't represent in their minds what their constituents were actually eating, and either for traditional purposes or for religious purposes and cultural reasons, that they felt that their particular sector were eating more fish than what was represented in that fish consumption rate. We also had a discussion with EPA that EPA felt there was more local data that would represent actually more consumption rate for Oregonians for fish. So we began back in 2006 to really look at how we would to examine that particular rate and come up with a different rate. And I'd like to point out that it was really important for us to have a collaborative effort, that we didn't want to be out there developing this without EPA and the tribes directly with us as three governments working on this particular effort. Now, the fish consumption rate is really used to calculate that human health criteria. So it's very important when we develop standards that we have a rate that's really representative of what is going on in the state of Oregon. And it is driven specifically by what we can have in terms of data from the consumption in the state of Oregon. And it's one of those standards that actually, as you think about it across the nation, as you look to set up a standard, if a state has the ability to look at just data that is from their state on this particular factor, then they can develop a rate that's really specific for the state of Oregon or any state that is. And the rate itself is very specific to protection of people who eat shellfish and fish. And as you develop that standard, it really is important to how we implement the Clean Water Act in Oregon, and I'll get into that in a little bit more detail in a minute or two. But the standard really affects many programs that we have at the department, but specifically our permit program. So as we set up new standards and we develop permits and we identify how much toxics a particular source can discharge, this rate really goes into determining what toxics and what amounts that they can discharge. So it's very important. And also, and I know everybody's heard the TMDL program, the Total Maximum Daily Load program. Again, this would affect how we develop the TMDLs. Now, when we began our effort, we actually went and established seven workshops across the state, and we kind of timed those out through the length of the project to really evaluate critical steps that we were taking throughout the project and to get the public involved in terms of what we were doing, give them updates on the various advisory committees that we were working with, and also to get from them some critical information that they would have on the fish consumption rate. We also identified two specific needs in terms of task forces or advisory committees for us. The first of those was the Human Health Focus Group, and it was really made up of professionals to sit down with us and review all the various fish consumption studies that have been conducted around the nation, internationally, and specifically in the Pacific Northwest. And what we wanted them to do is look at those studies and examine them and really identify for us those studies that they felt were scientifically sound, that we could rely on as a state to use those in developing this fish consumption rate. So they went through tens of different studies and really went through the science behind those studies and identified the ones that they felt that we could use as a state to really get down to identifying that fish consumption rate. In addition to that advisory committee, we had a fiscal impact and implementation advisory committee. And what we wanted that committee to do is really look at the cost of implementing a new standard using different fish consumption rates, and then also evaluate with us the various inputs that we could have for developing implementation approaches for implementing that particular standard. At the culmination of that effort of those two committees, the three governments sat down and evaluated that information. We went through the technical information developed by the Human Health Focus Group and also the fiscal information developed, and developed two recommendations. So again, I want to emphasize it was all the three governments sitting down together, looking at that information and developing this recommendation. And our recommendation was that we actually change the fish consumption rate, that we would increase it to 175 grams per day, and that we proceed with rulemaking for that particular fish consumption rate and identify implementation approaches that we could use as a department to actually meet those water quality standards developed with that particular rate. We went to the commission in October. We sat down, went through our reports and the basic information behind, science behind what we were doing. And the EQC directed the department to go forward and do rulemaking and to develop the standards based on 175 grams per day. They also wanted us to incorporate environmentally meaningful and cost-effective implementation approaches. And I'll get into a little bit of that in a minute as to what they were thinking of when they gave us that particular charge. And look at implementation strategies that would also include reductions in non-point source areas. And finally, to carefully consider the cost-benefit analysis and the cost of this particular program. So we sat down after the commission meeting and developed ourselves what our goals were going to be for this particular part of the project. And the goal was to develop environmentally meaningful, cost-effective implementation of water quality standards. And that would have two components. The first of those components would be to look at the Clean Water Act and the implementation of the Clean Water Act and what we would have to do to implement those types of standards within the requirements of the Clean Water Act, and then also look at an overall toxics reduction program for the department. Now, the reason why that's important, as we look at the implementation of the Clean Water Act, we're really looking at revising the standards, coming up with the new water quality criteria, and then for the most part, our regulatory approach would be to go to point sources and say, okay, traditionally would be to, you need to meet these water quality standards. So we'll sit down and put together a permit, identifying the permit, what your effluent limits are so that you can meet that standard. And usually the traditional thing would be to do then is that that particular source would develop a technology, a treatment technology, to meet that particular standard. Well, we look at these particular human health criteria developed in the future based on 175 grams per day. We will be getting numbers that are very strict, very low numbers for those particular facilities to meet. And in some cases, the technologies may not be available for them to get all the way down to these particular numbers. And so I can give you an example. If we were looking at a particular facility, and that facility had zinc in its discharge, and we were setting the limit that would require them to remove, say, 10 pounds of zinc from their facility, and there is a technology available that could remove 5 pounds of zinc, and our requirement in the permit is 10. So what do they do for the removing that additional 5 pounds of zinc from their facility? And what we're doing is exploring ways for them to link to other projects that the department may have. For example, if we have a facility that has a plating facility where they might have spilled some zinc in the soils, it may be in the groundwater in that particular site, is there a way for us to link the department's program so that particular source could go and actually pay for a cleanup program that would remove that additional 5 pounds? And that's a kind of an entirely new, different approach for the department, is trying to link water quality programs and meeting water quality standards and potentially using a linkage to another program so that we can reduce those environmental indicators out there, and so that we reduce zinc in the environment. So the last thing on this slide here is, in order to do that, we really have to, within the department, develop an overall toxics reduction program. So we can identify in the cleanup program, the solid waste program, and the hazardous waste program. All those programs, the potential for reduction of toxics in those areas, so that we can link to those and reduce those toxics in those particular areas in order to meet the reduction of these toxics in the environment. The next steps, we continue to have the collaborative effort with the three governments, because as we develop these approaches and we move forward with the standards, it's essential that EPA is brought along in through the entire process, knows what we're doing, is tied into all the technical work we're doing, the work that we're doing for the fiscal impact, but specifically for EPA to them to be tied into those implementation approaches that we've developed. We'll continue to work with other state agencies and the stakeholders, and we'll be setting up a process for the involvement of everybody into the process. We are currently right now sitting down and developing specific project management plans for the water quality element of this and also for the toxics reduction element. So we have two work plans in development to achieve both of those. So with that, I'm open for questions.
Thank you, Neil. I actually have a few which I'm going to ask before I forget them here. First is, do we need U.S. EPA approval for this limit, increased limit?
We do not need their approval for the limit itself, but we do need their approval for the standards that we would develop in the end of this.
Okay.
And as I mentioned earlier, we have submitted our 2004 standards to them, and they've withheld approval of those standards, and we still don't have approval of those toxic standards that we developed back then. And one of the major problems is to, you know, review the consumption rate to see if they should be different. So they're definitely a key player in this, and they have to approve them.
And what's the time frame that you think on that process?
Chair Dinkfelder, we're looking at developing the rule over the next year and hopefully having that rule to the commission by the end of next year, a year from now, or the very early part of 2010.
Okay. And then the question I had is, how does this fit in with Senate Bill 737 that we passed last year, which is also looking at pollution prevention and toxic reduction?
Chair Dinkfelder, a very good question. We have both of those efforts going on in the same section in the department, and what we're trying to do is very specifically coordinate the development of our rule for the water quality standard and identify, as we move along and identify the list of the persistent pollutants, that there is going to be a crossover. There's going to be an identification in that list of some of those contaminants that we are also probably lowering the standard on and developing a water quality standard for. The thing to remember in both of those efforts, the endpoint is really the development of a toxics reduction program. Whether you hold a water quality permit and you need to develop some type of program to remove toxics from your facility under the Clean Water Act and a standard, under SB 737, we're looking in the final analysis to identify a list, and if you have something on that list, you'll also be developing a toxic reduction program. And what we're trying to do is make that plan the same type of thing, make sure the requirements are pretty much the same so that we are doing the same thing in each of those programs as we go along.
Yeah, I was the just timing's making not exactly sure we're not right. Duplicating efforts with different programs, and given our current fiscal situation, I'm sure that's not in the best interest of the agency either. Finally, there hasn't been much discussion about non-point source pollution, and we know that there's no permits per se, so you're focused on the permittees and where you can reduce at the point source, also understanding a lot of the biochemical toxins that you're talking about here are probably a bigger concern with point source. But was there discussion about non-point source and looking at ways that we can improve our strategy for reducing inputs? I know we have our PMDL, Senate Bill 1010, Forest Practices Act, lots of different programs spread across different agencies. Was there discussion about that during these work groups?
Chair Dinkfelder, during the work groups, there was some discussion of it, but very specifically during the commission meeting in October, we talked a lot about that. And that in their directive to us, one of those very specific directives was to look at non-point sources and come up with a toxics reduction strategy that would really address the non-point sources in this. And one of the key things there is to remember is if the point sources need to reduce again, they'll be looking at different areas that they can go to reduce that particular toxics, and they may be able to fund things like a pesticide take-back program or something to that effect. If we identify a specific toxic that they then can fund a program to reduce that, it may in fact provide funding to remove some of the toxics that are in the non-point source arena.
Okay. Right, I've exhausted my questions for now. Committee members, you have any questions? Yes. Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, is there precedent under the Clean Water Act for allowing the polluter to find a more cost-effective way to achieve their reductions?
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Cannon, I'm glad you asked that question because it'll give Jennifer an opportunity to discuss this answer. Jennifer actually comes from us from EPA in their Washington, D.C. office, and she reviewed and approved standards across the nation, but specifically in the western part of the United States. And one of the things that we've been looking at are techniques used in other parts of the country to actually do that. And she has some experience in actually looking at and approving standards that use other techniques other than just technology-based and putting together toxics reduction programs. So I could let Jennifer answer that.
Thank you. And just could you state your name for the record, please?
Yes, my name is Jennifer Weigel, Chair Dingfelder and Representative Cannon. There are some precedents that we are specifically looking at to learn from and to build upon. A lot of those are based in the Great Lakes states where there are specific regulations that a lot of the states have adopted under their Clean Water Act authorities to look at ways to reduce chemicals of concern through their water quality standards program. And they do a lot. They have mechanisms by which facilities can develop what they call pollutant minimization plans, where they can think about holistically how not just technology and a pipe, but holistically how can they reduce certain types of pollutants from the environment. So some of the applications there have been a little bit more narrow than what we're considering, but I think it provides a good foundation for us to look at and build upon, and I think a lot of the pollution prevention concepts were integrated in a lot of the things that they are looking at there.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. We'll look forward to hearing more next session about the progress and appreciate all your hard work.
Great. Thank you.
We're actually now going to shift from water over to e-waste or electronic waste. I'd asked the Department of Environmental Quality, the solid waste folks, to come and provide us with an update on the implementation of that legislation was passed last session and is due to go into effect January 1st, 2009. And so we have Kathy Koala, DQ, and whoever wants to start first, Greg, and just please make sure to state your name for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Greg Aldridge, the Government Relations Manager at the Department of Environmental Quality. Today, we are here to provide an update on e-waste and its implementation, and with me is Kathy Koala, our e-waste project lead. I will give you an overview of the progress we've made since you passed this legislation back in 2007. Kathy.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. I am Kathy Koala with DEQ, and I'm the project lead for this fabulous program. As Greg said, this law was passed in 2007. It had unanimous support from the houses, and just to put this particular bill and project in perspective, Oregon was the sixth state to pass e-waste legislation and is one of a handful, a very small handful of states that have created a law or and a program based on producer responsibility, meaning that the manufacturers of the products have a more extended responsibility through the lifetime of the product. I've listed on this handout the objectives of the law, and essentially the law creates and finances a statewide system to create a network where consumers, nonprofits, and small businesses can safely and conveniently recycle their computers, televisions, and monitors. And we fondly refer to those as covered electronic devices. Watch order acronym for that. The law actually has requirements for manufacturers, for retailers, for DEQ, and for disposal site operators. And I will have a list of provisions listed here. I'm not going to go into those right now. I'm going to go into them in more detail in a few moments. We do have a couple of significant dates coming up. When we get to December 31st, we'll be closing down our registration cycle for manufacturers. That is it opened in October 15th and will close December 31st. And then on January 1st, we have the beginning of the collection program that will launch throughout the state on January 1st. We're ready to launch. We have just a few final details to finish up on, but the program is ready to go. The public end of the program is ready to launch on January 1st, and we're referring to it as the Oregon E-Cycle Program. Also on January 1st, there's a restriction of sales that goes into place. Retailers will only be able to sell products that are registered in Oregon. And also, retailers must begin to educate their customers at the point of sale when they go to buy these particular devices. So on to the next page. I provided just some very brief summary about some important parts of the project that we're working on. I mentioned that manufacturer registration is coming to the close of its cycle on December 31st. This is actually, we're in the middle of our second registration cycle. During the first one, manufacturers registered for calendar year 2008, and we actually had 205 manufacturers register with us. And they registered their products, and they registered their company with us. We have, moving on, the e-waste recycling programs. This is the network that the public will see out throughout the state. Manufacturers are required to participate in a program, and we are projecting that in our very first year, we had to come up with some projections. We estimate that about 12.2 million pounds will come through the programs. And this is based on about 3.3 pounds per capita. We have a lot of unknowns. We have the big television changeout coming up in February. That's a big unknown. We don't know how many people will be holding onto their televisions or moving them out. We don't know how many of these items people have stored in their garages or basements or spare rooms. So there are some unknowns. We had to come up with a projection, and we think that this is probably a fairly good one. So I mentioned that manufacturers have to join a program. It's either the state contractor program or a manufacturer program. And I just wanted to point out on the next page, just to show you how all of these programs fit together. The umbrella, and I apologize for poor copy here. The umbrella is the Oregon E-Cycles program, and underneath that umbrella are independent manufacturer programs and our state contractor program. So they are all operating under this larger umbrella of our Oregon E-Cycles program. And our state contractor program, DEQ has contracted with the National Center for Electronics Recycling to run the program on behalf of 178 manufacturers. Their collection system and recycling network is set up, and they're ready to launch. And they have a projected goal of collecting 3.1 million pounds through their program. In the manufacturer programs, we have had 4 manufacturer plans submitted to DEQ, and that represents 27 manufacturers. DEQ issued conditional approval to these plans. They have are in the final. We are in the final stage of approving them, reviewing and approving them. One program has already received its approval, and the other 3, I said, are in final review process. Their overall goal for all of those programs to collect e-waste is 9.1 million pounds. And on the other page behind the umbrella page, I just wanted to show you, this is probably one of the more complicated parts of the program, is what these different recycling programs might look like. Actually, they're very much the same as far as the requirements. whether they're the state contractor program or the manufacturer program, they both have to establish a statewide collection and recycling system, and that includes establishing a site in every city over 10,000 and then a service in every county. They have to have do some outreach and promotion. They have to meet their goals, and I mentioned the number of pounds each of the programs had. They have to pay for the system. They also have some safe management practices that they have to follow, environmentally sound management practices. And one of the questions we frequently get is questions about export and unsafe recycling of these products. And while we don't have, while the state does not have the authority to ban export, we do have the ability through this program to establish safe management practices. So each of these programs have to follow these management practices. If a product or an item comes in through the recycling program, those practices follow the item through the program. They follow them through the collection site, which has to have safe management practices. They follow it through to the recycler, which has to have safe and environmentally sound management practices. So regardless of where that recycler is, whether they're within Oregon, California, the other side of the country, or overseas, these requirements follow the programs and those products. I want to talk a little bit about retailers. Retailers also have requirements under this law. They are required, starting January 1st, to educate their customers at the point of sale about where they can recycle their old products. And we have developed a variety of materials to help retailers with that. And if you go to the last page, there is a sampling of some of the materials that were developed. We had retailers work with us. We had companies, representatives from Walmart, Fred Meyer's, the Mac stores, a variety of sizes and types of stores work with us. They said they wanted a variety of materials, that they were all interested in something different. So you'll see on this page, these are items that they can download off of our website. They're responsible for doing that, for printing them up, getting them to their customers. And so we've made it as easy as we can for them to meet that particular requirement of the law. The other thing that they're required to do is to only sell products that are registered in Oregon. And we have a website which has a list of all of those products. It is updated by the first of the month every month, so they can easily check at any time to see if they're selling what is allowed to be sold in the state. We currently have about 1,400 brands registered with us. Now, some of those are former brands and some of those are orphans, so products that we can't identify a manufacturer for. The outreach and education piece, DEQ staff has really been gearing up on this. We have we developed the name of Oregon eCycles. It's a catchy name. The public will be able to remember that. We have a brand new website that was launched a couple of weeks ago, and very easy to get to, OregonEcycles.org. And we'll have a phone line that the public can call. We've been out working public events, starting to work at public events, getting invitations from others to come out and talk with them. We've worked with local governments, given some orientation workshops so that they're aware of the program. They're very anxious to get word out to their citizens in their areas about the program. This has been something that they have sometimes taken on, the collecting of e-waste, but they are very much excited to be able to promote this program. We have an advisory work group that we've had in place and we've been working with since last October. We continue to work with them. It is we have a variety of representatives on that committee, everyone from manufacturers to recyclers to nonprofit organizations that do reuse to environmental groups. And they have helped us work through some of the hard issues. We've had the law. Some of the portions of the law we've needed to come up with some on-the-ground solutions for where it wasn't as clear as we've needed. So they've been working hard with us and have been extremely helpful. We are implementing this program through statutory authority. We don't have rules in place yet. So they've been very helpful with us. And we'll continue to meet with them as we move forward. And then finally, program financing. In 2008, our registration fees were, we invoiced a total of $389,000. We have the bulk of that is in, and those fees are used for program administration. They were designated through the law for program administration, and that includes everything from staffing to our outreach and education. We'll need to do some sampling of the returns that come in through the programs, reviewing plans, handling complaints. There's a lot of different activities that are handled underneath that administrative cost. For 2009, we are looking to collect just a little over $1 million in recycling fees, and that goes to fund the state contractor program. So that is all the cost for the collection, the transportation, the recycling, and the administering of that network. And we went through to the e-board back in September and received limitation approval for that. And then for manufacturers who are implementing their own recycling program, they cover their own cost. We have a couple of activities coming up in, that we'll be focusing on this coming year. We'll be finalizing the recycling plans approval. We will be launching that program on January 1, and we're ready. We have the pieces in place. We will be working on some enforcement strategies. We've had interest from not only manufacturers and retailers, but also collectors and recyclers who just want to ensure that there's a level, equal playing field for all. We'll be working on a disposal ban. That is a part of the law. That goes into place January 1, 2010, so we have 1 year of working with disposal site operators to get prepared for that. And we'll be launching into rulemaking towards the end of the year. As I said, we're working directly from the statute. We've been working with our advisory work group to figure some of these items out, and believe that we'll be ready for rulemaking. We'll have identified the items that need some additional clarity. And with that, I'll stop.
Questions? Representative Gord? Okay, so we'll go to Representative Canada for that. While you
Kathy, would you make sure that members of the committee get copies of your point of sale materials?
Yes.
Members of this committee?
Yes.
First of all, I think this is a very good consumer move forward, and maybe some of the folks don't know, but Chair Dingfelter was the author of this bill, and I think you deserve credit for it. Time will tell, but I think this is a good consumer bill, and hope you folks will come back to the legislature and let us know how the program is moving forward.
Thank you, Representative. I appreciate that. And I do want to say that I really appreciate the hard work of the agency and the advisory group, because passing one thing that I'm sure everyone knows, passing a law is actually the easiest part. It's implementing it and making the program successful, and that is what we've asked you to do. So I certainly appreciate all the hard work over the past year in setting this program up. There's members of the advisory committee that's been working on this issue for many, many years. Appreciate the hard work that's gone into that, and we look forward to hopefully successful implementation, because obviously that is the goal of the program, is getting these materials out of the waste stream and recovering them. And I'm going to be asking for regular updates. Certainly want to hear about job creation, because one of the things we talked about was, as we set up new programs, you know, locally, hopefully we're growing or creating new jobs. The reduction in costs to local governments, that was another issue that we had discussed, is that we wanted to make sure and offset any costs to local governments. And then third, the success of getting the word out on the program and how that's going. I think that's going to be really important over the next few months, especially with the holiday buying season coming up. And as you said, the transition in TVs, I think we're going to see a plethora of opportunities for recycling TVs. So I appreciate the hard work that you've done, the work of the manufacturers who have really rolled up their sleeves to work together to figure out ways to make this work. And we're still, I know, in the infancy of this program, but looking forward to your report back on that. And then finally, just to allay any fears of my colleagues, that this program is self-funding and does not utilize general funds, and I think that's a very good thing given the upcoming
fiscal situation we're going to be in. Representative Cannon?
Thanks, Madam Chair. How different will these programs appear to consumers? So assuming that the four manufacturer programs are approved, there will be a total of five options, in a sense, for a consumer who wants to recycle their electronic device. Will they have to sort through which option is best for them? Will that information be available? Will they have the opportunity to take advantage of all five in every community over 10,000 or every county in the state? I'm sort of still trying to figure out how this looks on the ground.
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, this is one of the more complicated parts of the program, but it is presenting some great opportunities for the citizens in Oregon. If all five programs move forward, what we could potentially have are five collection sites or opportunities in one area where perhaps now there are zero or one or two. For you or I going up to a facility or trying to decide which place we want to go to, DEQ will have on its website a searchable database. You'll be able to type in your zip code or name of your town, and it'll pop up all the available opportunities. It'll be transparent. We're not going to say this is the state contractor site or this is the MRM site. It'll simply say these are the sites available and opportunities available in your area. And I would be able to, I or you could take all of our product, all of these items to one site. So if it was me and I was ready to go, I could take my Toshiba laptop, my Sony television, and my NEC monitor to one site. So it doesn't matter by brand or by type of product. All of the sites would be able to accept all the brands. We may have one or two exceptions where they'd only accept IT, so computers versus or televisions, but that community would have all of those options still available to them.
It's actually a different question. There was an attempt made in the bill, and maybe it was a tepid attempt, but it was an attempt nonetheless to prioritize reuse over recycling, or say, if possible, where it's feasible, let's reuse the goods before we recycle them. Is that reflected in any of the plans going forward?
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Cannon. We worked hard. Some of the members of our advisory work group were members of nonprofit reuse organizations, and they were involved in the conversation, as were all the other members of the committee. This was a hard issue to deal with. We wanted to have good reuse and not a sham reuse, as some of the stories or video that you might have seen, they kind of rely on that type of avenue. What we have worked out for this first year is that we will be working with nonprofits. Nonprofits have been integrated as part of the collection network. They are able to pull off items that they would take into their reuse stream, so they may pull off items for refurbishment or for reuse and be able to take those out right at the point of collection. The rest of the materials would go through to the recycling stream. So for those reuse organizations that have a jobs program or have a mission of refurbishing these items and getting them out to community members or communities that don't have access to these, to computers in particular, they still have access to that stream. So that is our plan in the first year, to move forward with that and see how that works. It was a challenge to be able to set up a system that looks primarily like a recycling system but still allow for that reuse, and I think we came up with a good solution of having reuse organizations find and take those items off right at the very front of the system before they get into the system and start causing a burden or a cost inside of the system.
Just one final question. I appreciate the time. How active will you be in enforcing the point of sale requirements, and perhaps remind us exactly what those requirements are? There's a range of examples of ways that a retailer can publicize the program here. Do they pick from this menu, and would it be possible for them, for instance, just to sort of tuck away a business card, or are they required a sticker? I don't remember exactly what the bill says or what the law says about that, and I wonder what approach you'll take on enforcement.
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon. The law says that retailers need to provide something written to the customer at the point of sale. And so these examples that we've provided, a retailer can choose amongst them. If they wanted to do, for example, there's a sticker at the very bottom. There were some retailers that were very interested in being able to take a sticker, put it on the box of every single one of these items, and it has the required information on it. The law says that they have to provide the information provided by DEQ. And essentially, we have said they need to say these items can be recycled. You can find out about it at this website or this phone number. And so if a retailer wanted to use that method of a sticker on every box, they could do that. There's palm cards. These are very small, like the business cards they could have, be handing out every time they do a sale of these items. So they have a variety of ways to meet their requirements, whatever works best for their particular business operations. On enforcement end, we will be going shopping, mystery shopping, I guess, sometime after the first of the year, and we don't have all of our enforcement plans in place yet, but we anticipate going out and talking with our regional offices if they would like to go out and check on some of the retailers. We'll have a letter that will inform them what their requirements are and point them to the website for the materials. But we're still finalizing our enforcement strategy on that.
Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Gulley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just brief, Kathy, because I know we're kind of getting short on time, but two questions, and both of them are to refresh my memory. I don't recall exactly what we did, but what do we do about the rural communities? I mean, if I live out in Wagon Tire, which is not very close to a major population center, how do we deal with that? And I think a very related question is, what about Internet sales? If I buy my equipment over the Internet, how do we handle those transactions?
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Burley, for remote communities, there are some communities in the state that have not had any recycling opportunities for these items yet. So this program is really bringing something wonderful out to their areas. I don't know where Wagon Tire is exactly.
That's my point.
I have a map hanging in my office.
It's out in the middle of nowhere, trust me.
We have, the law said that these collection sites and opportunities had to be convenient to the population they were being served. So we have a two-page document defining convenience. One of the criteria was that it's close geographically to the population that's being served. It may be close. It may be convenient because it's at the shopping center or along the main highway that population typically travels, or they typically use that particular shopping area. So we have attempted to come up with some sort of measures of convenience. There might not be a permanent collection site in Wagon Tire, but there might be, if we have five programs that move forward, there might be five opportunities for folks in that region to either go to an event or multiple events or different locations in the surrounding area.
But just to clarify, the law said communities of 10,000 or more, and we talked about every county in the state.
Cities of 10,000 or more.
And every county in the state. And we had a lot of discussion about that during the development of the bill. And I know there's been a lot of discussion about the definition of convenient. Certainly, I think that's something we'll be tracking as this program moves forward, because the legislative intent was for it to be convenient and available, especially in rural parts of the state.
The second question about Internet sales, the law applies actually to all sales in or into the state, and so that includes not only the brick-and-mortar stores, but also sales that are made via Internet or catalog. So for those that are being made via all of those manufacturers that are selling those products in via any of those avenues have to register with the state. If they're selling via Internet or catalog, we've got some language that we've been provided to those particular manufacturers that said, if you are a resident of Oregon, there's a recycling program available for these items.
Yeah. Okay.
So we can do our own enforcement reconnaissance by ordering on the internet and see what comes up. Okay, any other questions? Okay. All right, thank you again for all your hard work. We'll look forward to seeing the results next month, hopefully, with the startup of programs. And I know we'll be hearing more about it next session, but I do want to thank the agency because I know you had many, many, many meetings. My staff has attended all those meetings, and I read all the minutes and certainly appreciate all the hard work you've done. And, of course, manufacturers who have worked along with the agency to make sure we have a viable and successful program. Thank you. Okay, next, we're shifting gears a little bit to energy, and we're going to hear a report back on the Renewable Energy Work Group. We heard from the Energy Efficiency Work Group last hearing, and unfortunately, Sylvia Hayes couldn't be with us, but we have Mike MacArthur, who's co-chair of that group. So thank you, Mike, for being here. Great, so don't do anything rash.
Now's your chance.
Okay.
Greetings. My name is Mike MacArthur. I'm here in my capacity as a co-chair of the Renewable Energy Work Group. Co-chair Sylvia Hayes sends her regrets for not being here. She's out promoting renewable energy today, I'm sure. The Renewable Energy Work Group was convened about 3 years ago to move forward the Renewable Energy Action Plan. It was developed by another group. We have had a very diverse group of interests represented. On the second page of your handout indicates the current roster. There have been people move in and move out over the course of our work. Many of them have actually changed hats. I often say at our meetings one of the most significant agenda items is the break, where our networking takes place. In this last interim, we have been working on a number of issues to move forward the Renewable Energy Action Plan's goals. Those recommendations were then forwarded to the governor's office to be included in the governor's climate change package. Essentially, there are two items that have come forth from our group that have been adopted in the governor's climate change package, and those are production-based incentive pilots. We've heard a lot of evidence that feed-in tariffs, as they're called, or direct subsidies for renewable energies are more effective in getting the sorts of results that one wants in distributed generation. So it was agreed that we would try a pilot, probably in the solar industry, to move forward some projects on solar power development. The PUC can do this mostly by rule. I'm not quite sure of what the source of the subsidy would be at this point, but the idea is that we would take a look at this over the next interim and try it. So the second would be an expansion of the business energy tax credit eligibility. If you think about the business energy tax credit, you can't participate unless you have a significant tax appetite, and generally it's matching someone's tax appetite to some other project. That's somewhat limiting for those of us that don't have large tax appetites or don't have enduring tax appetites that last multiple years. So the idea is to create a pool that anyone could participate in, much like a mutual fund, and that you could take a percentage of a project by contributing to the pool. The pool will be managed by Department of Energy. So those are the two items that are going to move forward as legislative concepts. There are a number of other ideas that we've worked on at the Renewable Energy Work Group, but for a variety of reasons aren't going forward, some of them, or going forward in another way. The first one is the Green Jobs Initiative, which we're told in the work group that can move forward by executive order. Sylvia is actually leading that effort along with Representative Cannon's staff, Christy Split, who's been very helpful to the work group in helping move forward that agenda item. So we understand that's going forward in a different form. There's some interest in the renewable energy commercialization and manufacturing program that expanding the BETC type tax credit to manufacturing and development of renewable energy. That, of course, has financial implications for y'all and the rest of the state. The transferability of BETC, there's some question about just how BETC credits can be transferred and if they can be transferred. So the idea would be to clarify that. Renewable energy research and development. just a direct grant program to help develop the industry further. Again, the source of the funds would be the problem. Third-party ownership of net metering facilities. There was a legal question that arose around particularly some solar projects, I think, in the Portland area, and whether or not the if someone else owned the tax credit, if they weren't, in fact, acting as a utility. PUC said no, but clarifying that statutorily may be something that would make sense. Insurance for renewable energy projects, a real obstacle to moving forward. Renewable energy often is some of the insurance requirements for instance, connecting to the distribution grid and helping smaller community-sized projects move forward. If there was a way to subsidize the insurance, that would help them. And then the question of BETCs for fuel cells. Currently, fuel cells that use renewable fuel sources are eligible for tax credits, but those that use other types of fuels are not. And so there's some interest in, because of the energy efficiency of fuel cells, making them eligible no matter what. So anyway, those are the things that we've worked on this year, and we'll continue to meet, and we continue to review some of the projects that or some of the legislation that was currently passed by y'all, and we keep an eye on the renewables portfolio standard to see how that's working. For instance, we hear about the renewable fuel standard and how that's working. So we continue to play our role as a reviewer of previous actions. I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Okay, thanks, Mike. Any questions? Representative Canham.
Thank you. Was there any discussion in the work group of the issue that surfaced in the news recently about the Betsy that was received by a company that had a significant debt to the state for fees, fines they had incurred? Did that come up in your discussion at all? Any sort of refinements of the Betsy when it comes to who is eligible for receiving this tax credit?
Vice Chair Burley, Representative Cannon, I don't believe that it has. I do understand that there is a review underway of the Betsy by Eco Northwest, that and a report will be coming forward to legislatures early in the session.
Thanks. Any other questions? Mike, I've got one briefly. The idea of this Betsy Energy Fund, I'm not quite sure why, given the fact that these Betsys are transferable, even if an entity does not have a tax appetite, they can transfer it. I'm not quite sure what the value of having this fund would be.
As I understand it, the Betsy matches a project to someone with a tax appetite. And if you don't have a sufficient tax appetite to fund a project, then you can't participate. So this would aggregate those tax appetites of smaller investors. And it would also allow people with limited, you know, if you only had a tax appetite for a year or two instead of five, you could participate through the pool.
I'm going to reserve that question for the next panelist.
Okay.
So I'd like to hear his thoughts on that, too. Any other questions for Mike? Okay, Mike, thank you very much.
Perfect. You got us back in time.
Perfect time.
Just needed to hand the gavel over. Wow, even a few minutes early. Okay, thank you, Mike. And we'll look forward to working with you next session as we move forward with many of these great ideas. I've been tracking that, the work of the committee, and the many folks have donated lots of time for that. We really appreciate it. Next, we're going to hear from Mike Rainey. There he is. Slipped in there on the wind energy siting criteria, and also Kurt Melcher and Ron England from Department of Fish and Wildlife. I think we asked to be here as well. Colleagues, if you recall, when we had our committee hearing in Bend, we had a discussion about facility siting criteria, both through FSEC, the Facility Siting Council, and through the local community level. And I'd asked Mike Rainey to come back and make a presentation, provide us with some background information. I talked to the chair of FSEC, Bob Shiprack, who couldn't be here today, but was very interested to hear how the discussion moved forward, and appreciate the fact that I know you've been working hard on this issue, Mike, so
like to hear your perspective, and I'm sure we'll have lots of questions for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, everybody. Mike Rainey, Director of the Department of Energy, and with me is Tom Stoops, who is the manager of our Energy Facility Siting Program at the Department of Energy, and Tom is lead on providing staffing to our Energy Facility Siting Council. I have two handouts today, and the first one that is a colored front that you've got in a moment there. But before you get that, let me just mention that there's really two phases of siting energy facilities. For large facilities, the Energy Facility Siting Council that we provide staffing for is the decision maker. And in Oregon, it's actually a centralized process, so all other state and local permits that would normally be issued separately are issued, or conditions from those permits are issued as part of that siting decision by the siting council. And the other state and local agencies participate to the extent they feel necessary in that siting process. There's also then, and it is intended for large projects, there's direct appeal to the Supreme Court or direct judicial review to the Supreme Court on an expedited basis for these large projects. The counties, in turn, have the lead for smaller projects. The counties are the primary decision maker, but then to the extent there would be other permits by state agencies or other entities of local government, those are still issued separately. Judicial review starts at a lower court than the Court of Appeals. So on the one hand, the county process is probably quicker than the state process, but if there's judicial review, that can take longer. So there's a trade-off there. And I think generally the system works well. It makes sense to have two processes, one for large projects that are more, have more statewide implications, and one for smaller projects that generally have limited implications. Let me show you, going through this this first handout that has the picture of the windmills on the cover. The first page there shows the operating wind facilities we have in Oregon. And we have over 800 megawatts, and about half have been sited by the siting council and half by the counties. And the counties, in terms of megawatts, with the siting council siting larger projects and the county siting smaller ones. That total combined is the equivalent of the output of one fossil fuel plant. If you turn to the next page, wind facilities that are under construction, and by that we mean well under construction and will be operating soon, another 900 megawatts. And again, it's about half and half in terms of those the siting council has cited in terms of megawatts and those the counties have cited. But again, the counties citing more smaller ones. And again, the 900 megawatts represents the output, even taking into account the capacity factor for wind, of another fossil fuel plant. The third page, wind facilities pending. The first column is wind facilities that have received license approval, that left column that construction is just beginning on. That's over 2,000 megawatts. And most of those have been cited by the siting council in terms of megawatts, about 1,600, nearly 400 megawatts by the counties. Again, in terms of number of projects, about equal there. That that amount, when those power plants come online, would be the equivalent of more than two fossil fuel plants. So these are having significant impacts. And then the right column on page 4 shows another 800 megawatts that are in process, under review. Again, by size, about half and half in terms of megawatts between the county and the siting council. More smaller ones by the counties. And we have been contacted by developers for hundreds of megawatts more. We're likely to see additional significant wind development. So these are having a significant impact on avoiding new fossil fuel plants and providing energy to Oregon and other states, and also meeting the renewable portfolio standard that was passed last session. The last page of this handout I want to point out to you is the timelines the Siting Council takes. These are based on recent applications we've reviewed. Generally, the biggest issue in terms of timing is time between time we receive an application and it's actually deemed complete. And that's a formal term of art under state law for the Siting Council and the department. And that can often take time because of issues that haven't been adequately addressed in order to start the formal process. Once that hearing process begins, though, the time to review and make a decision on the certificate, which is the final column, has generally been 4 to 5 months. The longest one we had was the 900 megawatt Shepherd's Flat site, which was recently completed by the Siting Council, and that one took 8 months. And that one is the largest wind turbine project, not only in the country, but right now in the world. So it was a large project. It did present some issues. All these projects so far, that have been approved on the page here were done without any local opposition, as I recall. The second handout I provide you is a model ordinance that we've provided to the counties. And I won't go through that. There's 22 different standards and some description of those standards. But we've worked with the counties at their request to develop standards that they can use so that that are comparable to Siting Council standards but tailored for smaller projects so that what we want to make sure is while we're promoting and developing renewable energy that these projects are sited appropriately because even renewable energy projects have environmental impacts. And so the model standard is a document that the counties can use in their siting process. Now, one of the issues I wanted to address is, in general, it's pretty clear when you have large projects should go through the Siting Council. Small projects, very small projects, go through the counties. There are some that are sort of borderline, that are gray areas. And the Siting Council threshold is 35 megawatts of energy, which for wind energy translates into, because of the capacity factor, 105 megawatts of capacity. And we have had, coincidentally, a few projects that have been cited at 104.5 megawatts, where the developers thought the county jurisdiction was preferable. We've also had the flip side, where developers have the option to come to the Siting Council if their project is between 35 and 105 megawatts. And they've come to the council where they thought perhaps their chances of approval were better than going to the county. So there has been a little gaming of the system. And one of the things we have done with the Association of Oregon Counties just recently is it was just agreed to at their recent annual meeting was to they're going to set up a task force of commissioners to work with us to using our model standards as a starting point to develop a basic set of standards that all the counties can agree to. Because counties don't want to be in a position either of being gamed either against the Siting Council or in turn other counties. And it makes sense that we use standards that are reasonably uniform throughout the state, recognizing that there will be some variation on smaller projects and some need for the counties to make perhaps decisions based on those smaller projects that using criteria that would be not entirely the same as the Siting Council. But we do think that it makes sense to have essentially comparable standards. One of the issues that's been important to the counties is adequately funding the technical review they have to do. We can actually provide that funding when they participate in the Siting Council process because we charge the developer all the costs for both our costs, but also other state and local agencies. With the counties, it tends to vary. It depends on, I think, their local ordinance and what the scope is, and there have been issues there. And one of the things we're hoping to come out of this approach is a uniform system so that counties aren't disadvantaged in terms of their ability to review either type of project. There are also some issues of sizing projects and tax implications. And again, we think it makes sense for the counties to receive the revenues they need from comparably sized projects, whether it's one, two, or four projects. And we've even had some situations where a developer would receive a site certificate from the siting council as one project and then come in and apply for 3, 5, or even 10 energy tax credits based on that these are multiple sites, and we've been reviewing that issue as well.
Well, that's a good segue because I had a question about contiguous projects.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have 204 megawatt projects that are contiguous, how is that dealt with?
And I think that's the key issue we're dealing with. We've had a few situations like that. We've had situations where I think there's been honest reasons why they've been phased in, legitimate reasons. There have been others where it's looked a little more questionable. Thomas, might be, do you want to add how we're approaching that with the Siting Council?
Sure.
Okay.
We have a series of 15 informal questions that we ask of the applicants when they come in and want to define to us how projects are separate. And I won't go into the details of those 15 questions. But what we're looking for are things that go to how they're going to operate their facility and then how they're going to retire their facility, amongst other things, to say that's why these are separate, that's why their market analysis says they need to build them that way. So we've probably had half a dozen instances where developers have come to us with those 15 questions, and we work through them in a series of meetings because they'll have projects that land ownership shows that they're side by side. Visually, they look like one project, but because of how they operate, they're actually two projects. So the easiest way to look at that is how they're going to sell their power. They'll have separate power sales agreements.
And a question about the counties, because and I didn't bring it with me, and you didn't hand it out, but I was reviewing the Plateau guidance that was developed. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that would differ from the criteria that you're looking at developing through the AOC with the Association of Oregon Counties?
What we started about a year ago with federal agencies, some folks from Washington State, county representation, and representation from developers, was a very focused look at how to go out and do the studies for the background information for our impact on the various habitat that occur throughout the Columbia Basin. We chose the Columbia Basin because those counties and state staff, Washington staff, that's where we've had most of our experience with wind. So we wanted to use that as a training wheel, if you were, to come up with what this informal guidance might be. What we culminated with after almost a year's worth of work was really kind of a floor that meets the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife standards for how you look at habitat, how you're going to do the surveys for the birds and bat species, and then how you're going to do mitigation. So what our hope would be is, as working with the counties in this upcoming process, that we could bring that type of informal guidance, because it came from all around the table, as to be a piece that would be the floor to say, you know, this is the type of work a developer should do so that you can understand the impacts and make that good informed decision.
So follow-up to that is that type of assessment required through the counting process currently, or only through FSEC?
I would say that's one of the places where in discussions with the counties, it's been uneven. Some counties have required those types of studies. Other counties are coming up that learning curve very quickly.
And I guess a follow-up, and we're going to have Fish and Wildlife Department come up here, is why not apply those type of criteria statewide? I mean, since we're seeing, I know initially we're looking at the Columbia and trying to have consistency throughout the region, but certainly since we're seeing more and more in the southeastern part of the state, looking at coming up with, you know, some type of guidance criteria that that ecoregion.
And Madam Chair, and that is one of the issues that the AOC task force will be working with us on. in addition to the general standards here.
Any questions before we bring up the Department of Fish and Wildlife?
And did you want me to address that tax credit question too, or
did you have a tax credit?
Well, Madam Chair, while you were out, Mr. MacArthur was testifying. I had a question that I wanted to also defer to Mike, so I don't know if you want to bring that up now or finish this topic and go back to that.
You can go ahead, and then did you have a question?
Well, I just wanted to make sure that I got the name of the person testifying.
I'm sorry.
Tom Stoops, Oregon Department of Energy, Facility Siting Manager.
So, go ahead and address the...
The question dealt with transferring the tax credit and the legislative proposal that has come out of the RUG to make that transfer easier. Currently, the business tax credit is transferable either if you have limited tax liability or you're a nonprofit or a public entity. But for that tax, that transfer to actually occur, we have to line up businesses with tax liability. And sometimes there can be a delay of some months for that to happen, especially if it's a large project, a multi-million dollar project, because the transfer can't occur until we have, and the payment, cash payment to the project developer, which is what they really need, can't occur until we have a business lined up. The idea is to allow individuals and businesses in this legislative proposal to make a tax deductible donation, or tax credit, I think, actually, tax credit donation, to a pool that would serve as part of the transfer money for the tax credit. So the tax credit could be transferred using funds from this pool in addition to specific businesses lined up that want to do specific projects. This is a new proposal, and I think we're going to start it out small. The draft that's being worked on with Legislative Council, I think, sets a limit of $1 million a year for this pool initially, just to see how it works. But that's the idea behind it. So this would supplement the work that's already doing on transfers.
Thank you. Thanks, Madam Chair. So if I understand what you're saying, I mean, if I'm a corporation and I want to get a tax credit, I can just write a check to this fund.
Yes.
For the purpose of a renewable project, which may never happen, and I still get the credit.
That's the question I had.
I'm Chair Representative Burley. Well, that's one of the reasons we're starting small, because this is new in terms of the department. There's some precedent in terms of other credits in the state and other states' credits, but this would be new for us.
Well, I'm assuming that our colleagues on the Revenue Committee will be carefully scrutinizing this as a proposal. But
that's helpful. Thank you, Mike. Thanks.
Thank you. That's all I have. If there's no questions, thank you.
I'm sure we'll have some other questions as we move forward with some of these facilities. I guess I have one quick question before we bring up Department of Fish and Wildlife. Are you seeing, because of the economy, any changes? Are you seeing any withdrawal of applications? I mean, we don't necessarily think that there's going to be a significant decrease in demand for energy, but we may not see the growth given the recession.
Madam Chair, I think it's too early to tell. I know in the last recession, we had 2001 and 2002, there was still significant use of the tax credit by businesses for energy efficiency investments in order to stay competitive. I suspect we'll continue to see that with renewable energy projects, especially the large ones. I think it's too early to tell.
Madam Chair, I think as long as we're on more sort of general questions about this subject, can you give an estimate of what percentage of this power will be consumed within the state of Oregon? I know it changes day to day, minute to minute, perhaps, but with all of this new wind coming online, there's a sense of what percentage of that stays in the state.
I'm sure with Ken, I think we'd have to get back to you on the specifics. I can tell you that historically Oregon was a net importer, I'd say until about 10 years ago, by a significant amount. And a lot of that is actually coal-fired plants from the mountain states that provides as much electricity as we get from hydroelectric. we are within the last few years, between the natural gas plants that we cited in the 90s and the renewable energy plants, we're pretty much net even. We import as much as we produce. We're no longer a net importer or net exporter. A couple of the projects that have been cited recently, most of their energy is going out of state, and that issue has been raised. With this, at the same time, the electricity market, the regional market, is a complex and interrelated one. We do buy power at times of the year from California, for example, even as we sell power to California. And Washington and Idaho and Montana and Oregon are very integrated in terms of transfer of power. So it is a complex question, but in general, we're probably roughly at parity. We can get you more details on that.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
And we'll have now the Department of Fish and Wildlife come up and just give us a brief, their input on the facility signing criteria and the projects that they've been reviewing. Thank you, gentlemen, and if you can, state your name for the record, please.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher. I'm the Deputy Director for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I appreciate the invitation to come here before you today and talk briefly about wind energy and the department's efforts in that arena. First, before I turn it over to Ron Anglin here, my Wildlife Division Administrator, just a couple brief words. We think, and we've been very satisfied with the work that's gone on in the Columbia Basin. We think that's been a great process. We also believe that these very important energy projects can be sited in an environmentally friendly manner, and that's consistent with our fish and wildlife priorities. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Ron Anglin again, our Wildlife Division Administrator, to say a few words about these sightings.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. I think that we've been very involved in the Columbia Basin process that you mentioned, Madam Chair, and the sightings that the document that the counties have worked on with Department of Energy, and we've been very involved in that and signed off on it as a good way to go when it's outside of the FSAP process. And what we're starting to see, though, is developers are really looking at opportunities in other areas of the state that are not tied into that Columbia Basin area and don't necessarily have anything within their county land use plans that address wind energy and some of the fish and wildlife concerns that we might have as an agency are not picked up within the county plans in relation to wind energy. So it's really kind of a growing pains process, I think, that there's so much happening so fast, and it's a matter of how can we collectively get ourselves plugged in together to make sure that sites that are picked are compatible with fish and wildlife uses and not having unintended consequences that nobody wants to face down the road. And then tied in with all of that, especially as you move into the southeast, is the secondary thing that has to happen is a distribution network. And then there's the footprint of putting in power lines, things like that, that people don't always think about in relation to just putting in the wind towers, is you've got to have a way to get the energy out. And so we're tied into those processes also. And we've been working very closely with Department of Energy on that. It's been a very good working relationship. But what we have seen is a huge impact on our staff as these facilities are being proposed, whether at the county level or through the FSEC process. And we have some districts where upwards of 50% of their time is being spent on wind energy projects now and taken away from other things. If it's through the FSEC process, we can get reimbursed for that. If it's not through the FSEC process, then we cover the cost of that through our normal funding streams. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to just go ahead and answer any questions that the committee might have.
Yeah, I did have one regarding outside of the Columbia Plateau areas. There are requirements. I mean, I'm pretty familiar with a lot of permitting processes in the state, both the federal and state level, but not as familiar with the process of a smaller wind project that's going through the county land use review. So is there any requirement for consultation with FMW or U.S. Fish and Wildlife if it's outside the FSEC process? I guess that's what I'm trying to understand. If that's just something that, you know, you get involved in, is there actual a requirement? I'm trying to figure out what the nexus would be for a land use planning if there's no endangered species. You know, what's the nexus there?
Madam Chair, it depends on each individual county plan, mm-hmm. and how or if their county plan addresses wind energy, and if there are Goal 5 resources, fish and wildlife resources, that are in the area where the project's being proposed. If those things are covered, then it kicks into a different level of consultation with the department. If those things are not addressed within the county plans, then we're just a commenter like any member of the public.
So it's probably also a question for DLCD about, I mean, part of it's the effectiveness of the Goal 5 inventories and how often they've been updated and, you know, all of the processes that go into our land use planning system. And we all know that counties are pretty strapped for resources. I mean, that's the concern I have, is making sure that the county planners and the counties have the tools that they need, that they're not being strapped just like your staff, and that those costs are being covered by the applicant. And so I'm assuming that that is determined by the counties, that application process. Sounds like you're not, your costs aren't being covered if it's through the county process.
That's correct. That's correct.
Okay. Obviously, this is an issue that we're going to have probably more discussions in the next session, especially with the challenges that we're going to have, you know, with our fiscal situation on every agency is being asked to cut back already. And that's a concern that I have, is making sure that we have the resources to do the, you know, support for the counties that's needed, and not putting that burden on an already overworked and overcommitted staff. So we'll have some more discussions about this next session, I'm sure. Any other questions? I appreciate your input, and certainly I'm going to look to you for any suggestions you have and ways that we can make the process work better, better coordination with the counties. I'm assuming you'll be part of the work group with AOC.
Madam Chair, we don't know that at this point. We would expect that would be the case.
Yeah. Well, I hope so. Mike's nodding his head back there.
Okay,
so
very good.
Certainly,
thank
since
you.
You're a key player in this, I want to make sure that both those issues of cost recovery are discussed, and making sure that there's resources available to support the counties in that process. Or do we need to look at a different state oversight process? I do have a concern that we have a facility that's 104 megawatts going through a very different process than 105, and that there's different burdens on the local counties for these different projects, and making sure that we're going to balance those demands, given that counties are going to be even more limited, I'm sure, with staff and time, given the cutback in staff. I know City of Bend laid off about 30 planners, I heard, and so they're and the counties as well are laying off people. So we want to make sure not producing undue burden on the counties as well. So appreciate your time, your input. Look forward to working with you on this.
Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you.
And we did have everybody here, but I'm going to move forward. I'm actually moving up the possible bill introduction now. I want to make sure we don't lose anybody, and then we'll have our last presentation. So I'm going to open a work session, and for the introduction of the committee, Measure LC 1496. Does everybody have a copy of that legislation? It should have been in your packet at your desk. I want to make sure everyone has it in front of you, including myself. And colleagues, remember, we've had a lot of discussions on this concept for gray water. And we've had, I think, discussions at our last two committee hearings about this. We've done a lot of work through the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I don't see anybody here from DCBS, but I want to thank them, working through the plumbing code and the different organizations that oversee the plumbing and well, it's mainly been the plumbing code that we've had quite a few revisions, and that's been done through rule. But we found out that there were other changes that needed to happen in statute that we couldn't address just through the rulemaking process. And DEQ actually, unfortunately, oh, Greg, do you want to come up and say a few words about this? Because we've been working pretty closely with DEQ on this, and I think it would be good background. I want to thank the Department of Environmental Quality. I asked them to work with the Department of Health, with DCBS, and Water Resources Department to help resolve this issue. So what is in front of you is many, many months of a work group that's come together to develop this language. And so if you can just provide us a little more information.
So be pleased to, again, Greg Aldridge, Government Relations Manager for Department of Environmental Quality. And here talking about legislative concept 1496, which is gray water. And this concept would actually modify statute to allow innovative uses of gray water, being defined as those waters that really do not need to go into the wastewater treatment system or the septic system. It'd be water that could be used on site. Usually think of it as coming out of your sinks and showers and like that. It's not your toilet water. It's not other water that would be heavily polluted with bacteria and like that where we'd have a concern. So this is working in conjunction with this committee and then obviously with DCBS to come up with the appropriate fixes in statutory language and then how we would need to change that in our own rules to go forward.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the hard work of the department. I've been working with the department for many years. This is the last piece of the puzzle in removing barriers to use of innovative techniques. What I found out is that if a developer wants to come in and have a gray water system, it actually is prohibited in statute. And in order to facilitate that, we needed to have the final language changes. So I want to see if there's any questions. McKinney, Representative Burley.
I couldn't possibly pass up asking a question on an LC draft. On page 5, line 27, proposed new language says optional requirements. Is that like saying maybe I have to do it, maybe I don't? What's an optional requirement?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, I can't actually answer that question right now. I can certainly look into it for you. Well, I think it's still allowing a voluntary.
I'm not going to be here when you guys work this bill. Yes. I just want to raise the point and put that on the record.
Committee staff, Beth Petrino, attended all the meetings, and I'm trying to recall the question about that one because there was some discussion.
Madam Chair, I believe the word optional is used here because it's using gray water is voluntary. It would not be required. Mm-hmm. So. I think that's why they use the word optional. But you can check into that further.
I would submit that you've got to find a little better wording than that. It's an oxymoron in my dictionary.
Okay, we will look into that. Unfortunately, Neil Mullane left, who was at most of these meetings, and would like to know what the rational sort of description of why that word was put in there, because frankly, I don't remember the discussion about having optional in there. And my suggestion would be to take it out. So, any other questions about the suggested language changes? Okay, and I would entertain a motion.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cannon.
I move that LC 1486, dated November 17th, 2008, be introduced as a committee bill.
Okay, is there any Representative Cannon moves that LC 1496, dated 11-17-08, be introduced as a committee bill. We've already had a suggestion that the word optional be removed and certainly would suggest that we have a discussion about that. I'd certainly like to hear from other folks what their thoughts are on that.
On that point in particular?
Yeah. And then any other, points of discussion?
I agree. It seems confusing But I also understand the desire to not prescribe that people establish a gray water system. So we want to make sure the bill doesn't require the department to set a rule that would require people to reuse gray water, since that's not the intent. It's meant to be voluntary. It's not clear, I think, in this draft.
Okay. Well, Beth, will you talk to the department about that? Because the other question I had is, do we want to say something about providing guidance? As an optional, you know, instead of optional, you can provide guidance. But I agree, we want to make sure we're not mandating use of gray water. It is an option, and we want to have it as an available option. Representative Correa.
Madam Chair, we're in discussion on the draft.
Yeah.
Some folks may recognize the fact that the concept for this bill first emerged way back in the Land Use Committee in 2005. And I'd like to thank Greg and DEQ because they've been very persistent. By the way, I also want to thank you on the paint thing. I think the agency has done a very good job of continuing to pursue this despite a lot of obstacles. And I believe that in the end, when we get this passed, it will be a good bill.
Thank you, Representative Gordon. I will mention that we had a water reuse task force that started in 2003, I think, and this was one of the pieces of the puzzle, the last piece of the puzzle that was identified. And there's been a lot of volunteer hours that have gone into this by discussion from the plumbing board, advocates, developers that have a great interest in seeing this move forward. So I also want to echo the appreciation of the agency. I know it's taken us a while to get there, but I think once we can resolve this on page 5, I feel that we have some legislative language that had support from all the different groups that were working on this. So if you can, you know, we'll have a little more discussion about that. But I think at this point, is there any other further discussion? At this point, I'd like to recommend that we introduce it, and then obviously when it comes to the committee, there'll be discussion whether to change that language, take it out, change it to something else. So with no further discussion, is there any objections to introducing committee measure LC 1496? Okay, seeing none, the committee introduces LC 1496 as House Energy and Environment legislation.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I'll close the work session, open back the public information component, and we have one last presentation from the East Multnomah Soil and Water Conservation District, my SWCD. We have Jean Fike, let me make sure I say that right, who's the director of the East Multnomah Soil and Water Conservation District. Thank you, Jean, for coming in, and appreciate your patience.
Oh, thank you for making the time. I'll be brief. Chair Dingfield and members of the committee, my name is Jean Fike. I'm the executive director of the Multnomah Soil and Water Conservation District. Thank you very much for the opportunity to address you, and I realize we're before lunch and I will be brief. I'd like to begin by thanking the legislature for supporting the work of soil and water conservation districts by supporting critical funding for our responsibilities as local management agencies under the state's agricultural water quality legislation and the Federal Clean Water Act. This session we will be proposing a housekeeping bill that updates our enabling legislation to help us better meet the needs of constituents. Well, that's not the topic of my testimony today, I'll just say that the bill would enable districts to address a wider range of constituent needs, including energy conservation and alternative energy projects. I was invited to speak this morning about the work of my district, the East Multnomah Soil and Water Conservation District, specifically our innovative environmental work in the urban sector, including converting a former birthing hospital, former funeral home, into an urban conservation center, complete with composting toilet and cistern. I'd also like to explain briefly how our work fits into the work of conservation districts across Oregon and leave you with some information about how districts are able to leverage state funds. East Multnomah is one of 11 districts statewide fortunate enough to receive local property taxes. Our property tax measure was passed by the voters in 2004 and gives us important additional resources to address local priorities. Like other districts, we also pursue grant funds and a variety of other sources of funding and work with them extensively to leverage resources. To understand the East Multnomah Soil and Water Conservation District, and the diversity of our programming, which is somewhat unusual, it helps to think about the district that we serve. Our district begins at the Willamette River in downtown Portland and extends east all the way out to the Mount Hood National Forest, taking in communities of every size and rural areas in between. There are a wide range of environmental issues, as you might imagine, in that area, and our programs are designed to address that variety. In rural areas, we work on the sorts of things you might expect for agricultural water quality work. We address noxious weeds, streamside restoration and erosion control, mud and manure management, pasture management, off-stream watering, all the things that you might expect, as I said, from the water quality management work, and perhaps a few things that you might not expect. These are from a postcard campaign that we use to reach rural landowners using humor as a way to get across to folks and get their interest in our programming. In the urban sector, we work concentrating mainly on water conservation, toxics reduction, and stormwater management. The building that I mentioned and flashed past gives us some intriguing new ways to pursue this work. Our naturescaping program teaches hundreds of people each year how to use native plants and natural gardening methods in their home landscape to reduce irrigation, reduce or eliminate the use of toxics, and increase stormwater infiltration. We have an event every year called Welcome the Rain, which highlights our work in stormwater management and the work of our partners. This last year we had over 700 people attend that event. We teach people also how to build rain gardens, which are just home-scale bioswales. If you're familiar with that term, rain gardens just sounds nicer to us. Teach people how to build rain gardens, teach other ways of reducing impervious surfaces and to store water on site. All of these practices save water, prevent pollution, non-point source pollution, and or reduce stormwater discharge. It's one thing to talk about a rain garden and show a few slides. It's another thing, with our new building, we'll be able to talk about rain gardens, show a few slides, and then walk outside and show working examples. The new building, these are some of the other low impact techniques. The new building is very exciting to us. We will have not one, not two, but three different rain gardens on site with different design options. Our parking lot has a combination of poured pervious concrete and pavers set in sand, so people can see the difference. We'll have an artist doing a creative downspout planter that creates a green wall effect, sort of a cascading green wall effect. We'll have a whole variety of nature-saving plant combinations and different microhabitats so that we can show people what they might expect at their site, and they can get an idea of how it would look at their home. We'll use a cistern to capture roof water for irrigation. It's to be used during plant establishment. Once established, of course, naturescaping requires little or no irrigation, and our plan is to bring that water then indoors for non-potable use, flushing toilets and the like. And last but not least, should the call of nature occur during one of our workshops, folks can use our composting toilet and, while doing so, read about the advantages of composting toilets and some of the problems associated with the combined sewer overflow in Portland and the issues that creates for our waterways. We hope that this facility... Okay, there's my disclaimer. It's not finished yet. Sorry, you missed that. We hope that this facility and the hands-on education programs we offer there will inspire visitors and even passers-by, because it will look like an unusual place. I think it will get people's attention to embrace conservation on their home grounds, because whether we manage a large rural property or a small urban lot, we all have a role to play in water conservation and keeping our waters clean. Now, on the face of it, converting a funeral home to an urban conservation center with a cistern and a composting toilet seems fairly unique. We all know that we are unique, just like everybody else, and so it is with soil and water conservation districts. There are 45 soil and water conservation districts formed by state law in Oregon and one by tribal law, and each one is responding just as we are to the specific needs of their district. It's a very locally led arrangement. And as you might imagine, the environmental needs in different districts are vastly different. It's urban, rural, east side, west side, forest, rangeland, really runs the gamut. And the issues as well as the solutions and the tools that make sense in different areas varies enormously. setting. Just a few examples of that variation. It made sense last year for the Columbia Soil and Water Conservation District, who was facing devastating local funding, flooding, you may remember, put in place very rapidly restoration projects involving 43 local landowners and bringing approximately $1 million in local conservation funds into Columbia and Clatsop counties. It made sense for the Tualatin Conservation District recently to partner with Clean Water Services in an innovative ecosystem services trading arrangement to plant riparian buffers with this new and creative source of funding. It makes sense in Baker County to work in a six-agency coordinated effort to control juniper, for example, and in Hood River to work on irrigation efficiency projects, one recent project saving 5 million gallons in irrigation water. In all cases, it makes sense for us to seek maximum leverage and conservation payoff for the investments made. As one illustration of this, one of your handouts gives some information about the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program known as CREP. It's a Farm Bill program. I'm sure the committee's familiar with it. This handout gives some detail on the economic benefits that CREP brings to Oregon. This, of course, is a federal-state partnership that brings funds to Oregon in the form of land rental payments and cost share for project implementation. These are dollars, keep in mind, that go to building and maintaining natural resource infrastructure in our rural areas, creating rural jobs, and demand for local goods and services. The state of Oregon has been a partner in the CREP program since 1999 and is currently investing approximately $2 million a year through the OWEB fund to fund practice implementation technical assistance. In closing, given the economic straits that we're in, let me just mention what a bargain I think soil and water conservation districts represent. The soil and water conservation districts use local, federal, state, and other sources of funding to respond to local conservation needs in the ways that make sense to those communities, whether those needs are riparian restoration, irrigation efficiency, urban conservation, or increasingly all of these things and more. And I'm sure you'll be hearing more from the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts this session about the housekeeping bill I mentioned and about the work of districts. Thank you very much for the opportunity, Madam Chair. And
thank you. Actually, we're going to hear about that bill in the Ag and Natural Resources Committee, which Representative Gerard and I both sit on. But as a former SWCD employee, I appreciate all the work that you do, and certainly having worked on the ground with landowners, know that you're right there on the front lines. Looking forward to seeing your new facility. Maybe you can use gray water now to irrigate your bias whale. Or
Madam Chair, yes, I was very excited to hear how far that bill has come, and we're very glad to see that we'll be using as a cistern water initially, and gray water, should we have the opportunity, is something we'd like to look at as well.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for Jean? Certainly, I hope you're going to invite us on a tour, even though it's not physically in my district. I think it's in Representative Kotek's district.
If I could just mention, we actually have an open house coming up December the 8th at 6 o'clock. Okay. If anyone's in the neighborhood, please stop by.
Right. If you can email Beth, she'll make sure and get that invitation out to everyone. Thanks so much. Okay. Appreciate you being here. And with that, we're actually out a few minutes early. I will adjourn the House Interim Committee on...
Madam Chair. Before you hit that thing, I would just like, as the, as the opposing party on the committee, to thank you for your leadership on this interim committee. I think you've done a great job in, if I can use the term, keeping this committee fair and balanced.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative.
I thank you for your efforts, and I wish you very good wishes in your new job in the Senate.
Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed chairing this committee for the past 2 years, and certainly appreciate Representative Reed was not here during the session, but appreciate that he decided to join us during the interim, and all the hard work of the committee members as we've gone through some pretty challenging issues over this past couple of years. So appreciate everybody's attention. I know that there's been some pretty technical information at times that isn't always sexy, but obviously we've been able to get a lot done, and I think it reflects the hard work of not just members, but also our wonderful staff, Beth Petrino, and we've had wonderful committee staff all throughout. So thank you. Look forward to working with you all, obviously, from the other side of the building. And with that, we'll adjourn the House Interim Committee on Energy and Environment.